This is Mental Selling. This is the sales podcast for people that are dedicated to making a difference in customers' lives and have a purpose beyond just a paycheck. I'm your host, Will Milano. Let's get right into the show. We're 22 times more likely to remember and internalize a story than a series of facts or bullet points. You correlate the story to similar experiences that you've had, and as a result, it narrows the distance between you and the other person. Stories bring an emotional element that pulls people in. If they can relate to you and what you're talking about, that begins to build trust. So, why then are most salespeople not leveraging storytelling to its fullest potential? If stories build stronger customer connections and make lasting impressions, where's the disconnect? My guest today on Mental Selling is Matthew Dix. And if he sounds familiar, it's because Matthew was my guest for episode 49 several months ago for a great discussion that we had around how to be more productive, stave off procrastination, create new habits, and just be more productive as a salesperson. Thanks so much for coming back and talking with me again, Matthew. It's great to talk to you.
It's my pleasure. Storytelling is something I talk a lot about, and I'm thrilled to do so.
Yeah, at the end of that episode that I referenced, episode 49, so for anybody listening, if you haven't heard that episode with Matthew, it's really good. But at the end of that, you and I talked about having you come back later to talk more specifically about storytelling, because we didn't have time to do it in that. So I'm glad we're doing this now. So, Matthew, we talk a lot about how buying for a customer, it's more emotional than logical. And about bringing things like more humanity and personality into sales so that you build trust and credibility faster. So why then, if those things are all true, don't salespeople use storytelling more? What do you think might be holding them back?
It's a really good question, because I work with a lot of sales teams, and it's like I bring a crowbar into every meeting, hoping to pry them away from their old habits and into new. You know, the same problem exists, I'll point out, in education. So many teachers are sort of like black boxes to their students. They don't want their personal and their professional life to cross. And that's very stupid. And that is saying it kindly. And I think probably the same thing applies to a certain degree with sales. You know, if you start talking about yourself, your kids, your life, your hopes and dreams, vulnerability, those kinds of things, it sometimes doesn't, I think, feel like the most professional approach to the job. I think that vulnerability and storytelling can be frightening, both because it's not done very often. So you have to sort of be at the tip of the spear, which is not always easy. And I think a lot of people tend to think they don't have anything to say. And so they stick to the script and they see it as a numbers game. I'm going to deliver the pitch as had been constructed by marketing, and then sort of torn apart and reformatted in the way that I think it should have been. And I'm just going to do that over and over again. I'm going to play that numbers game, and I'm going to get my sales that way rather than, you know, spending any time sort of building what you described as trust, making a friend even as one of your customers.
Yeah, the vulnerability aspect is probably important, because storytelling by nature, right, is opening yourself up and sharing your own experiences. And maybe there's like a fear of rejection there, that sort of thing, or that it's going to fall flat.
Or it might just feel odd. Like, I love to talk about how I had the windows in my house replaced. A very expensive process. I actually had to go through three different rounds of it in order to sort of get it all done. I had five companies come in and show me their windows. And I went with Trevor Devine and his company. And he did not have the cheapest windows. He did not have the best windows. I went with Trevor Devine. I did not go with the window or the company. I went with a human being who came into my house and talked to me about golf and smiled at my kids and chatted with my wife. And I thought, I want Trevor Devine in my life. Like, this is the guy I trust. He sold me doors too. We bought the doors for the house too. And maybe 4 months ago, my storm door became loose. And I have a cat that wants to escape, but is not an outdoor cat. So if he gets out, I'm in trouble. And having a loose storm door was a problem. And so I called Trevor and I said, I don't know if the door is still under warranty, but can we arrange for it to be repaired or replaced? And he said, I'll come by later this afternoon and take care of it myself. And when I got home from work, the door was fixed. And I thought, that is why I went with Trevor Devine, because I knew that he was a person who I could trust and who I liked and who liked me. And I get that kind of service because of it. But it was only because of the time he spent with me and the way we connected through story.
Right. And it just comes back to that simple idea that people still buy from people. They don't want to buy the faceless, nameless product.
Right. The story I love is, I cannot remember his name at the moment, but when encyclopedias were sold door to door, the most successful encyclopedia salesperson in the country was a guy who said, every sale that I have ever made happened in the first 20 seconds I walked into the house. He said, I would walk in and I would inventory everything I saw in the house. And I would find something in the house that related to my life. And over the course of the sale, I would tell a story that I knew related to something that was important to them. So baseball bat leaning up against the wall, he's going to tell a story about his kid's little league team. You know, knitting on the couch, he's going to tell a story about his grandmother's love for knitting. Whatever it was, he said, that was the sale, was the 20 seconds. It wasn't the encyclopedias. It wasn't his good looks. It wasn't the pitch. It was, I'm going to get them to believe that I'm a good human.
And that might be one of the things we end up talking about a little bit later, is sort of the critical success factors or the attributes of great storytelling. And it sounds like one of them is that adaptability, you know, able to think on the fly, think on your feet, and not just have a rehearsed, again, script that you're speaking from, right? You've got to be able to adjust in the moment based on what you're seeing.
Yes, or pre-prepare. So like when I do a keynote, when I'm speaking for an hour, I have 5 anecdotes in my pocket at all times, funny things that I know will bring the audience back if I feel like I'm losing them. And so salespeople should have their bag of tricks so that although you will be improvisational on the fly, you're really improvising from a bag of tricks that you already have. And you're just choosing which one to deploy at any one time, which is what I do, you know, all the time. I play golf with people all the time. And there's always like 3 of my friends and they add a 4th. And the way I handle that is I let them talk for 2 holes. I ask them questions about themselves and I gather as much information as possible. So by the 3rd hole, when I actually tell them something about me, I already know enough about them that I know which stories or which aspects of my personality or my life to deploy to maximize the chances of me making a meaningful connection with another person. But it's all like there already. I'm not coming up with stories on the fly. I have the stories ready to go. It's just a matter of choosing the one that I think is going to be most impactful.
Which gets to another critical sales skill, which is listening, right? Listen more than you talk, especially early on.
Yeah. Well, I always try to be the last person to speak in every room that I enter. You know, I went to an all-women's college for reasons that are sort of crazy. We don't need to get into, but I was in a room with all women every single day in my classes. And so I learned, when women go to an all-women's college, they go there because they don't want to have to deal with men in their classes. So when there's a guy like me sitting in the class, you quickly realize I need to not talk for a long time. And so I learned to listen. And now whenever I'm at a party, whenever I'm in a meeting, wherever I am, I try to be quiet or ask a lot of questions, one of those 2 things, for as long as possible. So that when I finally say something, I'm going to say something of meaning and not sort of flounder and just sort of throw something off into the air and hope it lands somewhere. I'm not throwing spitballs at the wall. I'm really targeting what I'm saying specifically.
We tell salespeople a lot that they should be helping customers envision new possibilities that they might not have previously considered. And in your book on storytelling, you said that the story must reflect change over time. So I assume the ability to tell good stories in part in sales fits into that well, because the biggest thing a salesperson is typically trying to convince a buyer of is the need for change. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Someone just asked me today, is it a story if there's no change over time? Can it be a story if it's suspenseful and surprising and hilarious? And I say, no, not really. I mean, you're describing an anecdote, which is fine, but it's not going to convince anyone. It's not going to get anyone to trust you. You know, those are fine stories. You know, you tell them when you're drinking beer with your buddies or you're playing golf with your friends or on a long car drive and you've run out of good things to say, you roll out the, here's a crazy thing that happened to me once. But if you actually want people to believe in you and trust you and to have faith in you, then you have to tell a story, which is change over time. Either you're going to change over time or you're going to describe the change they're going to experience over time and get them to believe in that change.
Well, it's a good distinction, right? Anecdotes and stories are 2 different things.
Yes. So the anecdotes are those 5 things I take to the stage when I'm speaking for an hour, which are not really things that are going to demonstrate change over time, but they're just the like, here's a funny thing that my son said that I know will make everyone laugh and make them sit back up and pay attention to me. Whereas a story is going to actually get people to believe that I have something important to say, and it's going to allow them to feel more connected to me, feel closer to me, make them laugh or cry at the end of a story. Those kinds of things will happen. If you're not having change, essentially you're saying something that happened to you in your life, which may or may not relate to something that's happened in your audiences. But if you're describing change, the beauty of change is it's so sort of synonymous with everyone. So even if my change is I discovered that I am more selfish than I thought I was, everyone understands what it's like to be selfish, even if it's not in the particular way that I am describing. They can relate to it. People can relate to change, and they believe in change more than they believe in the crazy story about the time you drove your car through the garage, you know, which is fine, but not going to convince anyone that you're an amazing, connective person. It's verbal candy is really what it is. Driving a car through the garage is verbal candy. It's going to make everyone laugh for a minute, but they will not remember anything you said 3 months later. Whereas if you tell an actual story about I used to be one kind of person and now I'm another, that may stay with them for the rest of their lives.
That's a good point. I read something else that you wrote recently that said storytelling is all about decision making and good decisions equal great stories. So I wanted to talk more about that because after all, like we like to say that selling is about helping customers make decisions that are in their best interest. So there's again, correlation there, right?
Yeah, well, I talk about it as decision making because I never want someone to feel that their facility with the language, their vocabulary, English is their second or third language. None of those things apply. Essentially, storytellers are people who think before they speak, and they think as much as possible before they speak. They make good decisions before they open their mouths. Most people don't. Most people say the first thing that comes to mind, which is why stories often start in the wrong place. They start in the first place a storyteller thinks. You know, so a first grader always starts every story with the alarm goes off and I open my eyes. Because in their mind, every story began at the beginning of the day, even if the story takes place at 8 o'clock at night. But adults aren't very different. If you're having dinner with someone and the story that takes place, the real meaningful story happens while you're eating dessert, most adults still start the story at the beginning of the meal or even on the way to the restaurant, when really that story should begin the moment dessert lands on the table. So adults fall into the same trap. And the trap is you didn't think about the best place to start the story. You just started at what felt like most chronologically appropriate. So making decisions is really important in terms of telling the right story.
So that actually syncs nicely with the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is when you teach people to become good at storytelling, what are some of the foundational aspects that you start with that people need to really buy into and internalize? Because I know, for example, you talk a lot about the importance of beginnings, which you were just talking about. So what are sort of essential core elements of great storytelling in the context of sales?
You know, I think what you have to start with is the end. You have to know where you're going first. You have to know what the destination is. You know, so if I'm telling a story, I'm telling a story about a moment in my life, and the moment is always going to be the end of the story because it's the most important thing I'm going to say. But today, for example, since January, I've lost 35 pounds. And so today I went to the beach for the first time this summer and I put on a swim shirt and it was enormous on me. Part of it is because it's stretched out, but it's also just an extra large swim shirt. And I am not an extra large anymore, you know? And so I sat down in my beach chair. I opened up my phone to the Amazon app and I ordered two large swim shirts thinking that's probably my size now. And Amazon sent me a message before I clicked buy. It said, "You normally buy extra large items. Are you sure that this is correct?" Right? Which was crazy because it's weird that the algorithm knows the old version of me, but not the new version of me. I might tell that story someday about the moment I sat there and Amazon reminded me I was once extra large and now I'm large. But the end of that story has to be the moment when I get that message and I realize, wow, not only is the world seeing me different, but now I have to teach Amazon that I'm different, right? That's the end of the story. I start with the end. And now I have to ask myself, if the end of the story is I have to somehow teach an algorithm that I'm a different sized human being, what's the beginning of the story? That's going to be the change over time. And that's going to be the beginning of my story, which is something in effect to the opposite of that. So the beginning of my story is either going to be the beginning of my weight loss, which is really just the decision to exercise hard, which is the only reason I lost the weight. You know, I discovered one day in December, I talked to my son for 45 minutes while I was riding the exercise bike. And it occurred to me, I should not be able to talk to my son for 45 minutes while riding the bike. That doesn't qualify as exercise. And that's basically how I was exercising. So on January 1st, I decided I'm going to work out really hard. Like I'm going to kill myself every time I do it. Make the best use of this time that I can. Maybe the story starts there. Or maybe the story starts at the first time someone noticed my weight loss. Hey, Matt, are you losing weight, right? Start with a person noticing it and now me having to teach an algorithm the same thing. Wherever it is, that's what a story is. We start at the end, at the moment we want to land in. For your customers, it's what's the moment we want them to see themselves in. And the beginning of the story is the situation they're in now where tragically they don't have your product or service, right? You're doomed for this reason now, but you will not be doomed once you buy my thing, right? And that's what you have to understand in the story. It's that beginning and end in concert with each other and oftentimes in opposition to each other.
It's that linking of current state and future state, right?
It could be, yes. It could be desired state. You know, in many of the business stories that I help companies with, a lot of times it's we need to tell our customer that their life is not as good as they think it is. Or that they think they're prepared. I'm working with a company right now, and what we're trying to convince the company is you think you're prepared for the oncoming problems of the world, but you're actually not because you don't have our product. And here's what that means for you. And so at the end of that story is essentially, would you like to go to bed at night not having to worry about the 8 problems we just outlined to you? You get to go to sleep at night knowing that these problems are being taken care of by professionals. By a platform that will solve all of these problems for you, right? And so that's the end of the story. So the beginning of the story is an iceberg is coming towards you and you don't even understand what's at the bottom of the iceberg. You don't even know what's about to hit your boat. And at the end, you get to put your head on the pillow at night and sleep well, knowing that we're taking care of an enormous problem for you. Those two things link together, though, very nicely.
When we talk more about the foundational aspects of good storytelling, how important is brevity? How do you know sort of what the sweet spot is for how long you can go on for without really losing people?
I often work with, let's say, vice presidents of marketing who are getting up to deliver a keynote. And inevitably, I hand them a 14-minute keynote and they say it needs to be shorter. Almost always, they need it to be shorter because they're terrible at what they do. Because they are ineffective at delivering content. And then the content they have been delivering prior to working with me has been boring in a multitude of ways. And so what they think is, since I know I'm bad at this and no one responds well to it, let's make it shorter so I don't have to suffer as long. But you can see that that's a terrible formula because you still suck, right? You're just going to suck for a little less, but it's not going to be any better for you in terms of results. And so in terms of brevity, the way to really think about it is how entertaining are you? Because the more entertaining you are, the longer you can speak. No one has ever accused Steve Jobs of going too long, right? And it's because he understands how to perform in a brilliant and extraordinary way, more brilliant and extraordinary than I think most people understand. So part of it is, are you entertaining? And then the other part is like, you have a certain bit of content to present. How much time does it deserve? So if I'm working with a supply chain company and they have a platform that will help companies mitigate their supply chain problems and, you know, all of these other issues that supply chains create, that's going to determine a certain amount of time. If I'm working with a company that's selling a broom, that story should not be as long as the supply chain company's story, right? So what you're doing often mitigates it too. And that in the real world of storytelling, whereas I stand on stage, same thing. You know, I had a guy once tell me, Matt, I want to tell a story in your show, but the story is going to be 14 minutes long. And I know you think that's probably too long. And I said, well, what's the story about? And he said, well, in the 1980s, I went to the Soviet Union because Russian refuseniks were starving. And so I brought VHS tapes to Russia because I could trade them for rubles and I could use the rubles to go into these government-run grocery stores and buy food that I could then get to the refuseniks. And I said to him, his name was Ron, I said, I don't know anything that you just said. It definitely is going to take 14 minutes. And it came out to be a fantastic story that required 14 minutes. You know, in that same show, there was a woman who told a story about being chased home by a dog when she was 6. And she made it home into the arms of her father. It's like a 3.5-minute story about how at 6 years old, she came to understand, as long as I can get home, I'll always be safe. That's what she's trying to say. That story deserved 3.5 minutes because it's a chasing of a dog down a street. So brevity, I would think more in terms of how much do I have to say based upon the content I have and how entertaining am I? Because if you're entertaining, I'm getting ready to do a 90-minute solo show, right? 90 minutes is a really long time. I had better be entertaining as hell. And if I'm not, my 90 minutes should be 12 minutes.
Do you need to be clear about how the story relates to, say, that sales discussion that you're having? Should a good story have to include, like, the reason that I tell you this is, or should that always be obvious?
It doesn't always have to be obvious. I call this speaking with adjacency, which is I'm going to tell you a story that is directly related to what we're talking about, but you will not see the relationship until the very end. And sometimes I might have to tell you exactly how they are related. I don't trust people, especially in an auditory medium. If it's written, people get to process information at any speed that they want. They can reread, they can read slow. But if I'm speaking, I worry all the time because people's bandwidth is just different depending on the person. So I can say a word, a vocabulary word that they trip up on. They're trying to figure out what that word was. So in storytelling, I think it's okay for us to be very deliberate and sometimes super obvious and say, I tell you that because I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing to say in a story.
When a salesperson hears things like tell more stories to customers, they might leap ahead and assume you're talking about things like customer case studies. But in sales, good storytelling is way more than that, right? It should be personal. It's got to be relevant to them. And just reciting a case study with sort of like, here's what they started with, here's what they wanted to solve, here's what we did, that's not a great story, is it?
No. And I don't think there's ever been a customer in the world who said, boy, I hope they have four case studies today instead of three, because four is better than three, right? Usually one good case study will do it. Or what I say is one really good one and then just touch three more very briefly. You know, just show us that this is what the case study is emblematic of, the big one. And then here's three other companies that have had similar results. I think when we say tell more stories, what we're really trying to say is find ways to connect with these human beings in such a way that they want to do business with you and talk to you again and have you in their life in some way. Like you said, people do not buy on logic, and case studies are logic. There's nothing emotional about a case study, right? A case study is you go back to your boss and say, yes, they've done business with other companies and it's worked out fine. That's essentially what a case study serves, right? It's verification that this company is real. That's really all it is.
Yeah, I feel like case studies, they're good to have, but they're table stakes. They're that sort of like check the box thing of like, did you find out how they've done this with other relevant companies to us? That sort of thing. But it's not a decision-making mechanism.
No, it really is sort of a like, okay, we're not their first customer. Good, right?
Right. When you talked earlier about vulnerability and that might be sort of one of the mental things that's holding a salesperson back from storytelling more. Storytelling is also a gateway to sharing humor, isn't it? And again, that's another area where salespeople, they might be hesitant to share because they don't want to try to say something funny that just falls flat and doesn't work.
Right. Well, the joy of storytelling is that if you say something funny and it doesn't end up being funny, you're still telling a story. And oftentimes it's not even noticed that you were trying to be funny, unless you're setting up, you know, joke and punchline, which you should probably not do. If you're just telling an amusing story and nobody laughs, you're still telling a story. But yeah, I mean, humor is the most underutilized tool in all of business. And it makes me crazy because you make someone laugh, you change their brain chemistry completely. It releases chemicals. So laughter increases their ability to comprehend through the release of a chemical. It makes them feel better about the world they are in. And it makes them feel great about the person who made them laugh. It's essentially, you know, the same thing as like giving them a drug. If you make them laugh, suddenly they're chemically predisposed to like you, like the environment they're in, and understand what you're saying better and remember you. And yet every time I try to get someone to be funny in the corporate world, they say they want to be funny. And then what inevitably happens, this just happened to me, someone goes to a conference with a funny talk. They hear the first two speakers, not funny at all. And so when they get up on the stage, they pull all the humor out of their talk because they don't want to be different than everybody else. They're afraid.
Right. When the exact opposite should be true, right? They should want to be standing out.
You should stand out no matter what, because if you do what everyone else does, you're ensuring that you will be forgotten. Probably, quite honestly, by the time someone gets to the car, they will not remember you. The only way to be memorable is essentially to be different in some way. And even if you are trying to be funny, and you fail to be funny, you will be memorable for your attempts to be funny and fail to be funny, as opposed to most people in most situations who choose to be utterly forgettable because they choose to be like everyone else. I say the corporate world's communication is round white and flavorless. That is exactly what they shoot for at all times. Whenever you try to add a little color or, hey, maybe we could add a little edge. Nope, we don't want any of that because that would be different than other people and that is not safe.
Where do salespeople tend to lose people when it comes to storytelling? Where can it start to unravel and what can you do to either prevent that unraveling or fix it and pull people back in?
Well, I would say the beginning is really so important. As you said, I believe in beginnings a great deal. I think in the first minute that you're speaking, you're either going to convince people that this is someone worth listening to or not. And if it's a not, they will leave you mentally and perhaps even physically. So if you can't find a way in the first minute to be entertaining more than anything else, I think you are in a lot of trouble. I was working with a company that helps find employees, we'll say, sort of like an Indeed version of a company. And the opening of our talk track and our pitch was essentially going to be, in the 1980s, when you wanted to find a job, you waited till about 3:30 in the afternoon, and a 14-year-old boy would ride his bike by your house, and he would throw a newspaper that would hit your door. And in the back of that newspaper, there would be one sheet of all the jobs in your geographic area, which is to say your town and maybe six surrounding towns. And that was everything that you had to choose from for a job. And every single day, that same thing would happen. And every single day, you would open up that same newspaper. And that is how you found every single job you ever had, unless you happened to know someone who helped you find the job. And the purpose of that was to show how there was a time when employees had no leverage in finding a job. And today they have all the leverage, which is why you need a company that's going to help you find the people you need and find the right people to hold on to and all of that. And it was going to be funny. And it was going to demonstrate an understanding and an expertise for the industry by saying, listen, we're going to go all the way back to the 1980s. We're going to make you laugh through nostalgia, which always makes people laugh. And even if you're too young to understand the nostalgia, it's a history lesson. So you either find it funny through nostalgia or you find it fascinating through education, but it's entertaining because it tells a story and you can see it visually. You can see a kid riding down a street, throwing newspaper, right? It's engaging as a story immediately, activates imagination, all of this. The CEO of the company said, why would we want to talk about the 1980s? Who cares about the 1980s? Let alone the fact that the 1980s are like the most popular thing right now. But forget that. Even if it wasn't true, that's a great opening to a sales pitch. And he threw it away because he thought, why are we talking about the 1980s? And so instead, they went with something that was incredibly boring, non-entertaining, did not activate imagination, doesn't do anything to make people laugh or demonstrate expertise in the industry.
And then you end up being that sort of talk about what year we were formed and how many offices we have and show the customer logo slide. And
yeah, get to the demo as quick as they can. Let me show you what the platform looks like. Let me show you what people see when they come onto the platform.
And one of the big problems that salespeople have today is people that go silent on them halfway through the sales process, especially if it's a more complex sort of longer term sales cycle. I would think that a lot of times that's happening because they've forgotten who you even are.
Right. And because you're not someone they want to spend any time with. I have some clients who tell me that they want me to teach a course on being a good consultant because so many of my clients have really become sort of my friends. And in many ways, I end up talking to them about things that have nothing to do with business. And it is only through storytelling and vulnerability and listening. I had a client tell me, I have never once believed, Matt, that you were looking at something else while you were talking to me. Like you're genuinely looking at me and paying attention. Whereas most people, I feel like there's a moment when they go and they check their email while I'm talking. And I just think if I was a salesperson, which I am not, that's what I would do is I would be telling stories and asking questions and being vulnerable and being an outstanding listener. So that if the sales cycle was, let's say, 5 meetings, they would look forward to the next meeting. You know, they would be like, oh, Matt, he was fun. Let's have him back. That's genuinely what I would do. You need to be that person.
And we've all got examples in our head of people that were like that with us. So we talked a bit about where salespeople can lose people when it comes to storytelling. Conversely, how do you know when it's working?
Well, one of the things I know right away is reciprocal storytelling. It's when they want to tell me stories that are related to the story that I have told, right? So I'm thrilled in the middle of a meeting if my cat crosses the table because now I'm a cat owner. And there's someone in the room who's probably a cat owner and they like me more for it. As Toby, my cat, crosses the table, I'm going to take advantage of that moment and say a funny thing about the cat. Not a story necessarily, but just letting you know that I'm a person who loves his cats. And then if someone says, I own a cat, and they start telling me a story about their cat, that's it. I have them. Like, because now I have told a story, and they've reciprocated with a story of their own, and now we're connected in a meaningful way. It doesn't feel like much, but especially in today's world where there's so much disconnect, a reciprocal story is going to definitely get it. The other thing is, and this sounds stupid, but it's so true. The head nod is everything, especially when you're in the virtual world, but in the real world too. All I do is watch for people to do this. And if they're nodding, they're absolutely with me. If I say something like, and here is why you absolutely need what I'm talking about. If they're nodding, I don't worry about them at all. I know I have them, and I probably have them forever. And if they're not nodding, I go, all right, I don't have her. And then I ask myself, do I need her? There's 8 people on the screen. I don't have that one. Is she a real key decision maker, or is she just hanging out, right? And a lot of times they're just hanging out. The ones that you lose are the ones you need to lose because they're not the ones that need to be in the meeting. You know, I've been in a million meetings that I don't actually have to be in, but someone else feels I need to be there, right? I'm not nodding my head in those meetings either. The head nod, reciprocal storytelling, I try to be funny. So if I get people laughing, I know I have them if they laugh too. You know, all of those things.
Especially in the last few years, you know, when everybody, like it or not, went on Zoom and was virtual, that idea of, you know, if you think 5 years ago, if somebody's dog barked or cat walked across their keyboard in a meeting, people would be horrified by it or be apologetic for it. And now people don't, everybody I know knows my dog. And half the people ask about him when I talk to him, you know.
Right. The people who use the virtual backgrounds or they glaze over their backgrounds and things, all mistakes, terrible. We should lean into the opportunity to be more personal with people while we're in our home environments. If you're in your home environment and your kid interrupts the call, you should be thrilled because your kid is cuter than you, more entertaining than you. And anyone who has a kid is now more connected to you because you have a kid and they understand it completely. So I tell people to strategically position things in the room so that people can see who you are and what you are and make those kinds of decisions. If you have a fake background, what you're really saying is, I am so afraid of vulnerability, I can't let you even see what my house looks like, you know? Or if you've sort of fuzzed it over, you're like, I am so insecure, I want to create sort of that gauzy image of my room, which looks better than the actual sharpened view of my room. All of that's a disaster, I think.
Even if you're not talking about it overtly, it's an opportunity to create that sort of human element that everybody craves.
I'm an elementary school teacher. So for the March, April, May, June that I had to teach my students before, we went back to school in September the next year. But for 4 months, I had to teach online. I was purposeful in that I moved my computer and my location around constantly with my students. So I'd be in my bedroom and then be in my kid's bedroom and then I'd flip it in my kid's bedroom because every time I changed the environment, it was more engaging for the kids and they would see things about me that they didn't see before. Now I'm kind of locked into 2 offices these days, right? This office and another one. But I am purposeful in that sometimes I'll say like, all right, I'm gonna let them see this part of my room. And then, all right, today we'll see this part of my room, you know? So I'll do that as much as I can. And I'll do it in my upstairs office as well, just to let people know I'm a human being and I'm occupying a space.
What about storytelling in more public settings? Meaning like in a group or if you're speaking at a conference or on a webinar that, you know, 150 people are on, or you're posting a video on social media that hundreds or thousands of people maybe are going to see. You've been on stage as a TEDx and Moth speaker, et cetera, many times. And I would think there's a much more heightened degree of vulnerability that people have to be comfortable with doing that. So why should salespeople perhaps step out of their comfort zone and make the stories that they tell more broadly visible than in one-on-one settings? What's the opportunity if they do that? And what are any sort of considerations about doing that versus in a one-on-one meeting?
I think what we've said before is still holds true is that you get to be different when you do that. When I do TEDx talks, if you ever see any of them online, I open with a story. And I open with a story that is related to my idea. You know, I have an idea to share. The story is somewhat related in some way, but I'm purposely opening with a story because once I'm done the story, everyone will believe everything I have to say after that. Because I've done all that chemical brain stuff with them and I've gotten them to believe in me as a human being and they like me. And now I have an idea to share. And if I was selling something, I would do the same thing. I always use brooms. I have a fictional broom company that I use with all my clients. But I would talk about something related to my home and something related to the cleanliness of my home or my childhood. I'd probably actually use my childhood. If I was selling my broom company, I would probably talk about how when I was a kid, I grew up in a house on a farm that had fly paper hanging from the dining room ceiling. There were that many flies in my house. And yet my mother swept the floor 3 times every day because that was the thing she could keep clean. That was the one thing that she sort of had control over, right? And so today, as the CEO of Acme Broom Company, I am taking my mother's example to heart. And that is why I have designed the most effective broom there is on the market. Now, I do a longer version of that story probably with the flypaper. I'd put myself in the story too, because right now it's just my mother in the story. So I'd have to be in it as well. I'd lean into the relationship that my mother and I had to make some of those connections. But ultimately, I'm going to tell a story about flypaper in a dining room and a woman trying to control one thing that she could control. I'd probably talk about that story for 2 to 5 minutes. And then I'd pivot to my idea, which is I have designed the best broom in the world in the honor of my mother. But that's what I would do rather than saying, today I'd like to show you the best broom in the world. No one has ever wanted to hear the next sentence of that story. No one in the world cares about you having the best broom, nor do they believe it's the best broom. But if I tell you about the flypaper and the barn and the horses and my mother and the floor, and then I say, I have something I want to share with you, you want to hear the next sentence of that story. And so that's why we tell stories, to get people to believe in us and want to hear what we have to say. Otherwise, you're trusting that people want to hear what you have to say, which is a terrible mistake because no one ever wants to hear anything you have to say ever unless you give them a reason to hear it 100% at all times. And that goes for everything. When I get on a stage and I tell a story, even the most amazing thing that's ever happened to me, my assumption in my heart is nobody cares about me. And so if I don't say a sentence that causes them to want to hear the next sentence, and then the next sentence, and I don't build a chain like that, then no one wants to hear from me.
When customers go silent on you sort of midway through the process, can you refer back to, in email even, or in a voicemail, the story somehow that you had told early on that seemed to resonate with them? Can you refer back to things that might get them out of silent mode and like, oh yeah, I remember Matthew. Yeah, I remember when we talked about that. That was funny. And
that's a great question. I mean, I don't think I've ever advised someone to deliberately do it, but I could see myself doing it. You know, I could see if they've gone silent and I really still think there's a possibility to make a sale, I'd probably use humor. I'd probably say something to the effect of, I know I told you that story about my mother's broom, and I'm hoping the flypaper didn't turn you off because it was pretty gross, but it was real. And what I have to offer you is real too.
That's a good example. It's got a touch of humor and it harkens back to something that they're very likely to remember that made you stand out. Can you tell stories in writing?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes it's required, right? It's the way you have to do it. And it's very similar. I think that the mistake people make is the written version of the story does not sound natural enough to engage people. And oftentimes when I see these stories written on paper, you know, or lots of my clients send me emails, hey, we're about to send out this series of 5 emails. Can you read through them and tell us what you think? And the change I make most often in all the emails is I add white space to the emails. I say, nobody wants to see your giant block of text. And then I'm often scratching out like every 4th sentence because they're always overly complex. And then I'm trying to reduce the formality of the language. When people think that I'm going to put it in writing, now I have to always write with a complete sentence, you know, and I can't sort of use the ease of language that I might use when speaking. And I say no, because it's what they hear in their heads. Nobody's reading this out loud. They're reading your thing in their head, and they're either going to hear your voice or they're going to hear some weird formal version of you that is not going to feel as connected to you anymore and not going to be engaged.
Which is why things like leveraging video, if you're sending out emails to prospects and things like that, and creating those little 60, 90 second videos of yourself, that's probably a much better medium for sharing a quick story that might be relevant.
Oh yeah. I mean, no one's doing it yet, or very few people are doing it, but I'm desperately trying to get people to, when you're sending a marketing deck to someone, you should have a video attached to it. There should not be a marketing deck where someone's flipping through the slides without you talking to them while they're flipping through the slides. And the technology is so simple these days that you can do it with ease. I do it for my students all the time, and yet I can't get corporate people to do the same thing, which is preferred, I think.
Oh, yeah. I would think you should never send PowerPoints out, you know, just by email for that exact reason, because you can't give it voiceover.
Right, exactly. There was a time when I would send like a newsletter or an email to the parents of my students. And then during the pandemic, I started sending videos instead because I felt we needed more connection. I never went back to the written word. And parents love it because they're like, I can cook dinner and listen to you talk to me about the things I need to know. And can you imagine in the business world, it's essentially going to be the same thing, which is I can listen to you. And if you're entertaining, fantastic. While I'm doing some menial task that I'm required to do at my desk, or while I'm getting up to get a cup of coffee, you can keep talking to me in the video. And that's fantastic. I just think that's a brilliant way to go.
Thank you for listening. And I really hope you've enjoyed this episode of Mental Selling. Please make sure that you're subscribed. And as always, leave us a comment or a rating, share it with your networks. You'll get more content like this on our website at integritysolutions.com. Until next time, I'm Will Milano with Integrity Solutions. Thanks very much again for being